Well, yeah, and it's worth noting that Chiang Kai-shek had been heavily involved with the narcotics traffic through a fellow by the name of General Tai Li. Tai Li, in turn, who was described sort of as Chiang Kai-shek's Himmler. He basically was Chiang Kai-shek's intelligence and internal security chief. The bulk of his organization was provided by a Shanghai narcotics and organized crime syndicate called the Green Gang, headed by a man named Tu Yuesheng. So that, in essence, Chiang Kai-shek's national security apparatus was inseparable from the narcotics traffic in that part of the world. And in the United States, the China lobby here became heavily involved through people like General Albert Wiedemeyer and others with Chiang Kai-shek. Now, in Southeast Asia, the China lobby, not only in the Golden Triangle through the Kuomintang, but also eventually through representatives of the China lobby that got involved, that participated pivotally in the U.S. involvement in Vietnam, helped to bring the narcotics into the United States. Again, in Radio Free America number 24, we covered the evolution of the narcotics traffic in Southeast Asia at great length and the pivotal involvement of the Central Intelligence Agency in it. Now, it's worth noting also that as we looked at in Radio Free America number 24, the growth not only of the Sicilian mobs and the American syndicate's involvement in narcotics traffic, but also that of the Corsican syndicate themselves, the Union Corse, were spurred greatly by the Central Intelligence Agency, which used both organizations, as an anti-Castro cadre, an anti-communist cadre in that part of the world. So that the original involvement of people like Lucky Luciano and the various Corsican gangsters, so some of whom we're going to look at in our next Radio Free America, stems directly from their role as anti-Castro, anti-communist guerrillas for the Central Intelligence Agency. But the China lobby and their minions in Vietnam and the Kuomintang involvement in Burma, in Thailand, in the so-called Golden Triangle, and the long-standing involvement of Chiang Kai-shek's forces in the narcotics traffic are front and center here. One of the things we looked at in Radio Free America number 12, the third of our Aryan Nation series, was the evolution of elements of the China lobby into the Cuba lobby. The aforementioned William Pauley, mentioned in the chapter we just read, was a key figure who was involved with the China lobby, and then became one of the most vociferous advocates of Operation 40, the series of guerrilla raids carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency against Fidel Castro. It's worth noting, too, that we took a look at the involvement of members of the China lobby with the Aryan Nations milieu that we looked at in our Aryan Nations series. We took a look at Claire Chennault's American Volunteer Group and how their name was adopted by a proposed assassination squad run by Nelson Bunker Hunt, or financed by Nelson Bunker Hunt, in Texas and elsewhere. So the China lobby is inseparable from the things that we're looking at here, and in turn, elements of the China lobby, one of the things we looked at in Radio Free America number 11, was the involvement of China lobby figures in the assassination of President Kennedy. So again, the Kennedy assassination is one of the things which looms very, very large in the background of what we're talking about. Elements of the China lobby, and in turn, the China lobby's evolution from the MacArthur group that we looked at, the involvement of anti-Castro Cubans, the involvement of many of the members of the syndicate, such as Santos Traficante, Carlos Marcello, and others, or probable involvement in the Kennedy assassination should not be overlooked here. One of the things that we should stress, perhaps, with regard to the material that we're reading from Henry Krueger, we're going to try and spell as many of the names for you as we can, because some listeners have expressed confusion about how some of the names were spelled. But beyond that, we're not going to be able to go over every detail, to put it mildly, in these chapters. Krueger is a very, very dense writer. There are an awful lot of names and events that are going to crop up here. We are just not going to be in a position to stop and analyze every single one. So bear with us as best you can, because Krueger's the pace he sets here is unmerciful, and you're going to hear an awful lot of names, and we're not going to be able to go over every one of them in the detail that we might like. So we're going to proceed now with the establishment by the Nixon White House of basically an assassination squad, which eventually came under not only the supervision of the Nixon White House, but also the DEA, that was initially or allegedly supposed to eliminate major narcotics traffickers. In fact, it appears that what it was used to do was to eliminate the competition of Nixon's organized crime and intelligence associates for control of the narcotics traffic. We're going to take a look at Kruger's thesis that is in fact what they were doing in a little bit. Returning again to Henry Kruger's The Great Heroin Coup, in a chapter called White House Hanky Panky. Never had Richard Nixon's White House staff been so preoccupied with narcotics matters as in the summer of 1971. They were obsessed with two projects, a new White House intelligence and enforcement unit as envisioned by the Houston Plan, and a comprehensive narcotics control apparatus, similarly under direct presidential control. The two idée fixe converged in a conspiratorial and political criminal network of hitherto unimagined dimensions. That summer, the White House set up the Special Action Office for Drug Abuse Prevention alongside the Special Investigation Unit, otherwise known as the Plumbers. Several of the Plumbers also worked on narcotics affairs. The group's key figures included Egil Krogh, K-R-O-G-H, Chief Plumber, who followed John Ehrlichman, for whose law firm he had worked part-time, to the White House in 1968, within months of his graduation from the University of Washington Law School. He was named Deputy Assistant to the President for Law Enforcement, and within 3 years found himself in charge of both Nixon's narcotics and law enforcement campaign, and of the Plumbers Squad. His single-minded ambition surfaced in a declaration to the noted psychiatrist and narcotics expert, Dr. Daniel S. Friedman, when the latter refused to support one of Crow's programs. Quote, "Well, don't worry. Anyone who opposes us will destroy. As a matter of fact, anyone who doesn't support us will destroy." Crow would wind up in jail for the break-in at the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, Dr. Lewis Fielding. Walter Minnick, M-I-N-N-I-C-K, temporary plumber, a young graduate of Harvard Business School and a former agent of the CIA, who joined Crow's narcotics staff in the spring of 1971 and later helped draft the reorganization plan that created the DEA. John Caulfield, plumber, a former agent of the New York City Police Department's Bureau of Special Services, which specialized in narcotics and, quote, "monitoring the activities of terrorist organizations," unquote. In the 1960 presidential campaign, he had been assigned to protect candidate Nixon in New York City. That and his close relationship with Nixon's personal secretary, Rosemary Woods, of 18-and-one-half-minute tape gap fame, gained him a foot in the door of the White House. Miles Ambrose, the former customs commissioner, who was named head of the narcotics campaign's domestic strike force, he would later leave government service in disgrace. I would interrupt here that Miles Ambrose also represented the Rajneeshpuram organization in their recent difficulties, and a program about Rajneeshpuram, a regular One Step Beyond program, is on permanent file at DAVCOR if you'd like to look at it, or listen to it, I should say. Continuing with Kruger's account here, and many of the people whose involvement both with, that he names as being involved both with narcotics enforcement and with Nixon's Plumbers Unit, that was the group which affected the Watergate break-in and precipitated the Watergate situation, or at least that aspect of it which appeared on the surface to the general public. G. Gordon Liddy, plumber, a former FBI agent whose narcotics intelligence job at the Treasury Department had been terminated only weeks prior to his recruitment by the White House for his outspoken lobbying against gun control legislation. Eventually, he would get 6-20 for his role in the break-in at the Watergate complex and 1-3 for the job at Fielding's office. Howard Hunt, plumber, a former CIA agent closely connected to the agency-trained Cuban exiles, many of whom had emerged from Santo Traficante's Cuban narcotics mafia. Hunt was employed as a special advisor on narcotics problems in Southeast Asia. In November of 1973, Judge John Sirica would sentence him to 2.5 to 8 years, reduced from an initial 35 for the Watergate break-in. Lucien Conein, C-O-N-E-I-N, a CIA agent, Ed Lansdale's right-hand man in Vietnam, and an expert on Southeast Asian narcotics centers in the Corsican Mafia. He was brought into the White House by his old buddy Hunt. David Young, a plumber, a young lawyer who put up a sign outside his office, "Mr. Young, Plumber," when apprised that he would be plugging leaks and that the trade had run in his family. He came to Crow's staff from Henry Kissinger's National Security Council. And I would just say that at broadcasting from Fort Hill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills.
Continuing with the great heroin coup. It was a strange mix of novices and experienced agents with the most intriguing pasts. Hunt and Liddy were located in room 16 of the executive office building, headquarters for the Plumbers Group's secret narcotics missions and other crooked operations on behalf of the committee to re-elect the president, also known as CREEP. The Plumbers' first assignment was the break-in at the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist. For the break-in dirty work, Hunt enlisted Bernard Barker, Eugenio Rolando Martinez, and Felipe de Diego, three of his Cuban friends who had been involved in the Bay of Pigs invasion. Martinez and de Diego also took part in the CIA's follow-up Operation 40, and the ubiquitous Martinez was in on Traficante-masterminded boat raids on Cuba. By the summer of 1971, the White House death squad was well on its way. Hunt sought out Barker in Miami for what Hunt called a, quote, new national security organization above the CIA and FBI. Barker would assemble a force of 120 CIA-trained exiles for Operation Diamond, which, under cover of narcotics enforcement, would kidnap or assassinate political enemies. Barker signed up. In the fall of 1971, Hunt asked another one of his Cuban friends, Bay of Pigs veteran Manuel Artime, spelled A-R-T-I-M-E, to set up, quote, hit teams for the liquidation of narcotics dealers. As later revealed, Artime's primary target was to have been the Panamanian strongman, General Omar Torrijos. Crow and his staff, meanwhile, tightened their grip on narcotics control. After the BNDD takeover, that's, by the way, is the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs, after the BNDD takeover of Customs International Jurisdiction, Crow pushed Bureau Chief John Ingersoll for results to feed Congress and the press. In September 1971, Crow was named to direct the newly formed Cabinet Committee on International Narcotics Control. In collaboration with the State Department, BNDD, CIA, and Henry Kissinger's office, the committee coordinated the international struggle against narcotics. State Department narcotics advisor Nelson Gross, chosen to supervise the joint actions, was later sentenced to 2 years for attempted bribery and income tax evasion. Egil Crow was less than satisfied with existing narcotics efforts, especially those of the CIA, whose intelligence reports, according to Ingersoll, were decisive for the work of the BNDD. Crow wanted the White House instead to handle the BNDD's intelligence work. Nixon's staff would then decide which drug traffickers to pursue. Crow's dissatisfaction was expressed to Hunt, who immediately proposed an Office of National Narcotics Intelligence, ONNI, where all narcotics intelligence reports would be analyzed and follow-up actions decided. Hunt told Crow he could enlist for the office experienced CIA figures, starting with Lucien Conein at its head. Nixon, however, chose William C. Sullivan instead. Once second to J. Edgar Hoover in the FBI, Sullivan had managed Division 5, which investigated espionage, sabotage, and subversion. He also directed Operation COINTELPRO, the Bureau's vendetta against dissident political and cultural groups such as the Black Panthers, and had been Nixon's choice to direct the Houston Plan's elaborate surveillance of U.S. citizens. Excuse me, Houston in this case, spelled H-U-S-T-O-N. Hunt, nevertheless, found a niche for his friend. Conein was assigned to the BNDD as a, quote, strategic intelligence officer, and came to control overseas narcotics intelligence, originally the domain of ONNI, while Sullivan... excuse me.
While Sullivan concentrated on domestic affairs. Incidentally, the Houston Plan was an abortive plan developed by the Nixon White House in which all U.S. intelligence activities would be combined into a single giant U.S. intelligence agency rather than the various different agencies that we have now, such as the National Security Agency, the Defense Intelligence Agency, CIA, and others. Continuing with the Great Heroin Coup. The White House now controlled narcotics intelligence at home and abroad, but that still wasn't enough. Nixon's staff also sought to control enforcement itself, and that required effective strike forces. In January of 1972, the White House set up the Office for Drug Abuse Law Enforcement, ODALE, according to a plan conceived by Gordon Liddy. It became the domestic strike force under Miles Ambrose, whose government career ended with news of his pleasure trip to the ranch of a Texan indicted for narcotics and gun running. ODLE soon became notorious for its record of illegal raids, no-knock entries into private homes, and beatings of innocent people. Some called it the American Gestapo. Overseas as well, the White House was dissatisfied with the BNDD's enforcement powers. Dr. J. Thomas Ungerleider, U-N-G-E-R-L-E-I-D-E-R, a member of the National Commission on Marijuana and Drug Abuse, noted in a record of his conversations with BNDD officials, quote, "There was some talk about establishing hit squads, assassination teams, as they are said to have in a South American country." I'm going to read that sentence again. "There was some talk about establishing hit squads, assassination teams, as they are said to have in a South American country. It was stated that with 150 key assassinations, the entire heroin refining operation can be thrown into chaos. Officials say it is known exactly who is involved in these operations, but can't prove it." Hunt, Liddy, and others in Room 16 did not confine themselves to narcotics campaigns and political assassinations. On behalf of CREEP, that's the Committee to Re-Elect the President, they raised campaign funds from more or less shady sources and sabotaged the campaigns of George Wallace, Hubert Humphrey, Edmund Muskie, and George McGovern. Hunt's CIA colleagues are among those who suspect he spiked Muskie's lemonade with an LSD-like substance prior to the candidate's famous tearful speech. Besides Hunt's Cubans, the familiar Frank Sturgis, who had earlier taken orders from Santo Traficante, took on narcotics work and special assignments for CREEP. According to a 1972 FBI report, sources in Miami had claimed Sturgis was then associated with organized crime activities. He later told an interviewer that he had aided Hunt in a 1971 investigation of the drug traffic reaching the U.S. from Paraguay via Panama. He was in on several actions connected with the investigation, which focused exclusively on Auguste Ricord's Grupo Francais. Interrupting, Auguste Ricord is a Corsican gangster and Nazi collaborator who ran a very, very important drug smuggling ring. We're going to talk about that in our next broadcast. Sturgis was everywhere in the hectic spring of 1972. In May, he was among the men who assaulted Daniel Ellsberg on the steps of the Capitol. Later that month, he and Cubans, including Bernard Barker, arranged a Miami demonstration in support of Nixon's decision to mine Haiphong Harbor. Sturgis himself was at the wheel of the truck leading the procession. He helped recruit agitators to disrupt the Democratic National Convention, and in the June 17th Watergate break-in, Sturgis joined CIA, Traficante, Cubans, and White House narcotics conspirators. As the noted Berkeley researcher Peter Dale Scott put it in 1973, quote, "In my opinion, it is no coincidence that the key figures in Watergate, Liddy, Hunt, Sturgis, Crow, and Caulfield, had been drawn from the conspiratorial world of government narcotics enforcement, a shady realm in which operations of organized crime, counter-revolution, and government intelligence have traditionally overlapped."
I'm going to try again. Continuing with Henrik Kruger's great heroin coup. In July 1973, Nixon's narcotic forces were essentially consolidated, according to Reorganization Plan No. 2, worked out by former CIA agent Walter Minnick, remember that's M-I-N-N-I-C-K, and Egil Crow. The Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA, was formed out of the BNDD, the ODALE, ONNI, and Customs Intelligence. 4,000 operatives, including 50 CIA agents, many of them Cubans from the ODALE hardcore, 500 customs agents, and most of the BNDD staff made the DEA a powerful new agency. Ingersoll of the BNDD, Ambrose of ODALE, and Sullivan of the ONNI all resigned as John R. Bartels, B-A-R-T-E-L-S, became the DEA's first director. His was no small task. Earlier rivalries persisted. The strange brew of agents with widely varying backgrounds and assignments made the DEA difficult, if not impossible, to steer. U.S. narcotics enforcement has a history of corruption, scandal, and exposure of agent collaboration with the criminals it has been assigned to police. Still, no bureau has been as plagued by scandal as the DEA has in 7 years of existence. And of course, this was written in 1979. Let me read that one more time. Still, no bureau has been as plagued by scandal as the DEA has in 7 years of existence. The exposés and charges run the gamut from trafficking in drugs, teamwork with the mob, and protection of major traffickers, to thievery, gun-running, torture, and assassination of drug traffickers. When Lucien Conin became the head of the DEA's Special Operations Branch, he allegedly carried out an assassination program after setting up the DEA's Special Operations Group, DEASOG, under cover of the B.R. Fox Company, and housed on Connecticut Avenue in Washington. DEASOG's 12 members, the Dirty Dozen, were hard and experienced Latino CIA agents transferred over to the drug agency for the occasion. Prior to DEASOG, Conin had set up another DEA, quote, intelligence operation, Deacon One, employing Cuban exile veterans of CIA training camps who were supervised by 30 other Cubans, all formerly of the CIA's clandestine services. In response to the claim that DEASOG was a, quote, hit team, Conin told journalist George Kreil, quote, that is a big blank lie. That is bull blank. However, a DEA official had told Kreil, quote, when you get down to it, Conin was organizing an assassination program. He was frustrated by the big-time operators who were just too insulated to get to, unquote. DEA officials also told Kreil that, quote, meetings were held to decide whom to target and what method of assassination to employ. Conin then assigned the task to three of the former CIA operatives assigned to the Connecticut Avenue safe house.
DSOG shared its Washington office with an old friend and colleague of Hunt and Conin's from OSS China, the weapons-dealing soldier of fortune and specialist in assassination, Mitch Werbel III. Werbel told Kreil he had been a business partner of Conin's as late as 1974, and that he and Conin had worked together on providing the DEA with assassination devices. Among Werbel's other associates were Frank Sturgis, Cuban exile leaders, and Robert Vesco, who, like Werbel himself, had been charged with bankrolling narcotic smuggling. Carlos Hernandez Rumbaut, R-U-M-B-A-U-T, the bodyguard of Vesco's close friend and business partner, former Costa Rican President Pepe Figueres, F-I-G-U-E-R-E-S, is a former Conin agent who fled the country to avoid imprisonment on a drug conviction. He has reportedly re-entered the U.S. twice with a U.S. diplomatic passport. Assassination, it can be argued, became a modus operandi under Richard Nixon. The CIA carried out assassination and extermination campaigns in Vietnam, Guatemala, Argentina, and Brazil, aided in Latin America by the local death squads. The White House appears to have sponsored a secret assassination program under cover of drug enforcement. I'm going to read that last sentence again. The White House appears to have sponsored a secret assassination program under cover of drug enforcement. It was continued by the DEA, which seemingly overlapped with the CIA in political rather than drug enforcement. Until 1974, the training of torturers and members of Latin American death squads came under the auspices of the CIA and USAID's Office of Public Safety. Some 100,000 Brazilian policemen, for example, were trained, and 523 of them were chosen for courses in the USA. They were trained at the International Police Academy in Georgetown, Washington, D.C., and at a secret CIA center in the same city on R Street, under cover of International Police Services Incorporated. When school was out, the prize pupils returned home to work, besides CIA advisors, as functionaries or torturers in such effective repression apparatuses as São Paulo's Operação Bandeirantes, OPERACIU BANDEIRANTES. Many would moonlight with the death squads. After Tupamaro's guerrillas kidnapped and killed U.S. police advisor Dan Mitrione in Uruguay, Washington School for Funding for Foreign Police came into the limelight and Congress cut off their funding. Nonetheless, the training program and direct assistance and supervision continued. A 1976 investigation authorized by Senator James Aberesk revealed that the U.S. torture academies had not, in fact, been completely closed down. According to Jack Anderson, Aberesk found such a school had been in operation since 1974 in Los Fresnos, Texas, at the site of a former bomb school. Another journalist, William Hoffman, later confirmed the existence of a school for torture in Los Fresnos, which had since moved to Georgia, where it was known as the Law Enforcement Training Center. Interestingly, Conin's friend Werbel runs his own large training center in Georgia, The Farm. It's used for, among other things, the training of law enforcement officers.
Continuing, much of the old police support apparatus was simply transferred to AID's International Narcotic Control Program. By the way, AID is Aid for International Development. AID's International Narcotics Control Program, otherwise known as INC, which really spelled DEA. In 1974, the DEA had some 400 agents in Latin America, or roughly the number of advisors recalled from the OPS program. INC's budget for technical equipment abroad, meanwhile, jumped from $2.2 million in 1973 to $12.5 million in 1974. The politics of the new drug effort were exposed when, in 1974, the man behind Argentina's death squad, the Argentine Anti-Communist Alliance, Social Minister López Rega, that's José López Rega, we've talked about him a lot, last name Rega, R-E-G-A, appeared on TV with U.S. Ambassador Robert C. Hill to publicize the two nations' anti-narcotics collaboration with the words, quote, "Guerrillas are the main users of drugs in Argentina." That's, of course, G-U-E-R, guerrillas. "Guerrillas are the main users of drugs in Argentina, therefore the anti-drug campaign will automatically be an anti-guerrilla campaign as well," unquote. It is striking how close the various extermination and repression campaigns have been to the narcotics traffic. The Mayo Army, deployed by the CIA in Laos, smuggled large quantities of opium. López Rega and his Argentine AAA henchmen were eventually exposed as keys to a cocaine ring. One of the chief AAA hatchet men, François Chiappe, was a lieutenant in the Record David heroin network. Cutting in, by the way, Dave already mentioned Auguste Ricord, and Christian David was an affiliate of his who also had links to various Western intelligence agencies, notably France and the United States. Paraguay's most ruthless high-ranking officers were exposed as heroin profiteers. Christian David took part in extermination campaigns in Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay. Operação Bandeirantes chief Sergio Fleury and several of his colleagues pocketed large protection payoffs. Fleury's number two man in the Sao Paulo death squad, Ademar Augusto de Oliveira, alias Fininho, fled to Paraguay after he was charged with murder. There, under the name Irineu Bruno da Silva, he worked for the Record Gang. I'm going to give you that guy's name real quickly and spell him for you. First is Operação Bandeirantes chief Sergio Fleury, F-L-E-U-R-Y, U-R-Y. Fleury's number two man in the death squad in Sao Paulo was Ademar Augusto de Oliveira, alias Fininho, I don't need to spell that for you, fled to Paraguay, there under the name Irineu Bruno da Silva. He worked for the Record Gang. When David's successor, the Brazilian narcotics dealer Milton Goncalves Thiago, spelled T-H-I-A-G-O, alias Cabeçal, the brain, was arrested in 1975, it was learned that he had been paying off the entire Rio de Janeiro death squad, which included four narcotics police lieutenants. And finally, as we go to press, we learn that the dictator Pinochet assumed control of Chile's cocaine trade, then turned it over to his secret police, DINA, D-I-N-A, which shared the profits with its Cuban exile henchmen. The political violence set in motion by the White House narcotics offices ran smoothly. But what of actual drug enforcement? From its inception, it focused on dismantling the French narcotics network. When that was done, America would be free of the heroin plague, or so said Nixon and his staff. Reports of increasing amounts of heroin from Southeast Asia and Mexico were obscured by the great public relations campaign on the struggle against the Corsicans.
The Turkey-Marseille U.S. heroin pipeline was indeed shut down, and the French Corsican mafia was almost totally decimated. But major new suppliers in Southeast Asia and South America were left untouched, despite warnings and reports, and despite the many CIA experts, unquote, on the Latin American drug scene. Not only were most major heroin suppliers in the two regions left alone, they were protected. And they were aided by the arrest of small-time competitors. At home, the story was nearly the same. ODALE and DEA nabbed only minor distributors and sidewalk pushers. Well, that's a mighty long segment to digest here. We're going to take a long musical break so that people can rest, since we've rest their brains and we'll rest our mouths, and poor Nip can rest his slightly flu-ridden lungs. And then we're going to come back. We're going to recap some of what we've just seen, and we're going to look at Kruger's allegations and analysis of the great heroin coup itself.
So don't go away. Dave Emery, myself, Nip Tuck, and as Dave put it, my slightly flu-ridden lungs will return with more of Radio Free America in just a few moments right here on KFJC. And we are back. This is Nip Tuck with Dave Emery in the studios at KFJC, going back to Radio Free America. We heard the Newport Rebels and a Charles Mingus song, Mysterious Blues. Great song. And after that, there's a specific reason why I played that long choral piece. Those of you out there who are classical music aficionados will recognize the... Get back to the stuff here. We've got lots more to talk about tonight. We're going to be continuing readings from The Great Heroin Coup, and we are going to be following up on the subject of the heroin coup itself, which was the point at which the Nixon White House and their special involvement in the drug trade, how they basically infiltrated the drug trade, how they used the special White House team, the plumbers, much of which also wound up operating in the Watergate case, to lapse over into the founding of the DEA, and in fact made the DEA a de facto murder and enforcement unit, and the Drug Enforcement Administration enforcing almost in the sense of mafia enforcers, to essentially rub out the old French and Turkish and Corsican heroin traffic and essentially swing it over to the Lansky Syndicate coming out of Asia and running through the Lansky holdings in Central America and South America and the Caribbean and up into the United States. So between a rather short period of time during the Nixon administration, this was accomplished. And as we talked about, not the least important factor is that Richard Nixon himself was already strongly connected to organized crime, and the fact that his own administration's previously unseen, something like this had never been seen before, that his administration's dealings in the drug trade should result in a massive windfall for the Lansky Syndicate and people who are already involved as organized crime people in helping the Nixon administration pursue their covert political agenda. Again, it stretches coincidence a little bit too far for those of us who have been studying this kind of stuff to believe, in fact, it was coincidence.
Now, again, the important part about the assassination team put together by the Nixon White House under a fellow named Lucian Conein was that most of the people involved in it were not only, quote, former CIA agents, but specifically there were very, very strong connections between this group and the anti-Castro Cuban exile community from the Bay of Pigs, which in turn was very much linked to syndicate elements involved and CIA elements involved in the narcotics traffic itself. Beyond that, this alleged anti-narcotics assassination team was heavily involved in the Latin American terror scene. Many of the same elements worked in conjunction with CIA in Latin America. So what we have is the Nixon White House putting together an assassination team allegedly to eliminate the international narcotics traffic. In effect, this assassination team functions as an extension of the U.S. intelligence system. Most of its agents are, quote, former, unquote, intelligence agents who appear to have been simply infiltrated into the DEA or the various Nixon White House drug enforcement bodies, because there were a number of them, in order to not eliminate the narcotics traffic, but to corner it, as we're about to look at, for the Nixon-associated organized crime and intelligence elements which have emerged so prominently in the story of the evolution of the narcotics traffic. We're talking Cuba lobby here, we're talking China lobby, we're talking Syndicate, Lansky, and Sicilian. And we're going to take a look now at Henrik Kruger's analysis of how this assassination team was employed. We're going to read now the 21st chapter of The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Kruger, called The Coup. Now, as the introductory remarks here are going to indicate, the thesis here that Kruger is developing is hypothetical. I agree with his thesis. I think his information is quite compelling, but he makes it clear that this is his interpretation of the events. The facts we've just laid out in the previous two chapters, here is how Kruger interprets those facts. This chapter contains my personal interpretation of the Great Heroin Coup. Errors are possible on any or all points, inasmuch as the clandestine operations treated in this book transpire in a closed world infested with lies and cover-ups. There will always be loose ends. The coup itself, which transferred control over the heroin gold mine from one part of the world to another, I regard as a fact of life. Similarly, do I regard the involvement of elements of the White House staff. Just how high up it went, the reader can decide for him or herself. Of the many heretofore mentioned details in the coup's planning and execution, I find the following essential. 1. Prior to the coup, Lansky Syndicate narcotics boss Santo Traficante Jr. had made the necessary arrangements in Southeast Asia and Mexico, and had started a war with the Corsican Mafia. Traficante's old partner, the CIA, had long since assumed control over Southeast Asia opium smuggling following Ed Lansdale and Lucien Conin's defeat of the local branch of the Corsican underworld. In 1971, when the coup's execution was seriously underway, Cuban exiles, a group with which Traficante enjoyed a unique rapport, appeared in the White House's mysterious narcotics operation. They were tied especially to Conin and E. Howard Hunt. Through a succession of bureaucratic reorganizations, the White House assumed control over narcotics intelligence and enforcement. U.S. narcotics officials waged an all-out war against the Corsican's Turkey-Marseille-USA network, while warnings of a serious heroin threat from Southeast Asia were all but dismissed. When the Corsican Mafia was neutralized, the narcotics enforcement apparatus was suddenly reorganized as the DEA, and shortly thereafter, heroin began flowing into the United States from Southeast Asia and Mexico. The CIA infiltrated DEA, grabbed control of Latin America's political repression apparatus, was accused of protecting major narcotics dealers, and was exposed as an accomplice to gun running financed with the profits from the narcotics traffic. The White House protected Robert Vesco, who appears to be a central figure in the scheme of heroin smuggling and gun running.
Continuing. In these 8 points, we find the will, the power, and the motives, not for the once proclaimed victory over the traffickers, but for the dramatic transfer of underworld power that suddenly became a reality in 1973. The syndicate was in on it. The White House, the CIA, and special lobby groups were in on it too, at least indirectly. But we still need ask who, in particular, and why. We will rely on logic and guesswork only to identify individual accomplices and their particular contributions and motives. Let us consider the Lansky Syndicate, represented by Santo Traficante and his Cuban narcotics mafia. In addition to motives he might have shared with the CIA, Traficante had many other reasons to take part in the heroin coup. First, it meant cheaper heroin deliveries and therefore greater profits. Second, he wanted the Corsicans out because, behind his and the rest of the syndicate's backs, they had begun setting up their own U.S. distribution network. Finally, Traficante's drug mob did not want to see a repeat of BNDD Operation Eagle, U.S. Drug Enforcement's last effective raid against his network. What were the possibilities for Traficante's playing an active role in the coup's execution, apart from preparation of the Southeast Asia and Mexico-based networks? Without help from the CIA and powerful lobbies, his chances were slim. With their assistance, he could infiltrate the narcotics nerve center, the White House. Here we might discuss just who, in fact, helped him. If it is true that Traficante fought the Corsicans so bitterly from 1971 on, how can it be that Marcel Bouquin and his shrimp boat were seized in February 1972 with 425 kilos of pure heroin en route to Traficante in Florida? There is only one explanation, which Bouquin himself offered in court, that Bouquin was set up by his American client. How else can the unprecedented seizure by French customs following a tip from the CIA be explained? If it was a plot to exhaust the stocks of the remaining French heroin rings and thereby cause panic among the Corsicans, then it worked. How guilty was Richard Nixon, who presided over the heroin coup? Personally, I believe that under strong pressure he was a more or less willing tool, rather than the force behind it all. pointing to Nixon's guilt are his close association with the Cuba lobby, with people connected to Lansky and Traficante, and with Robert Vesco. In addition, his Dirty Tricks Department relied heavily on Cuban exiles. The Cubans would never have supported him with dangerous criminal acts, demonstrations, donations, and votes if he had really been out to eliminate their most profitable business. Nixon would have been ruining the Cuban mafia and, to an extent, the syndicate as well, and thereby his friends in Florida. He would have been digging his own grave. Thus, Nixon tackled the drug problem, as he did every political problem. He followed the path of least resistance, and that meant ignoring his criminal allies in Florida and Southeast Asia while he hounded the Corsicans, who had no constituency, to death.